Hello, people of the night. Welcome to another episode of Sleepless Nights, a Greatest City Collective podcast. On today's episode, we have an educator and social entrepreneur with a passion for education equity, social justice, and helping children and adults develop an awareness, understanding, and appreciation for one another. She is the co-founder of the North Star Academy Liberty Elementary School, creator of the cultural exchange program Global Youth Connect, giving students from New York, South Africa, Cameroon, and India exposure to one another. The founder of Project 2043 Institute, helping me understand what lies ahead for the U.S. as we move towards hopefully a more diverse, equitable, and inclusive USA. Please welcome Julie Williams.
Hi, Julie.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
See, I wrote this and I was like, I know what these words say. This is why I need you here. Thank you so much for being here. I'm delighted to have this conversation about EDI, unconscious bias, microaggressions, racism, all of the things that go along with it, which all sound like the EDI and the unconscious bias and the microaggressions all sound like new popular terms and buzzwords, but they actually have quite a long history. And so if you could just take a second and tell us, for those who are not familiar with Project 2043, could you give us a little bit of background on the organization, yourself, and what you all do?
Sure. Well, thanks again for having me. So the Project 2043 Institute is an organization I launched about 4 years ago. And the purpose is really to help organizations that have decided that diversity and equity and inclusion and accessibility are critical to their success. Those organizations to help them take action and move forward on truly implementing a culture and business systems and processes that truly support that. The name comes from the Census Bureau's projection that in the year 2043, so about 20 years from now, the majority of people living in the United States will identify as a person of color. And I first saw this projection, must have been a decade ago. I was leading an elementary school in Newark, New Jersey. You mentioned Uncommon School, so I co-founded Uncommon School's Liberty Elementary School in Newark. And I remember seeing this projection and looking at my kindergartners and really starting to wonder what life would be like for them in a society where there was no racial majority. There was no group that had the majority, right? Would their humanity be honored? And would they feel more welcome in society, or would, you know, so many of these historical inequities just be even more further entrenched? And so it was always something that just fascinated me. And I got to a point where I was like, I want to do something about it. I don't just keep thinking about it. I want to do something. And so I was able to leverage my expertise in education and teaching in leadership to really start to help the work that I was doing within schools to help other organizations start to take some really concrete actions and educate them as well.
That is awesome, because we can learn more from each other. We have more in common than we think with people who don't necessarily look like us, don't have the same sexual orientation and things like that. We have a lot more in common than we actually know. And if we could know what we had in common, if we actually had a conversation with those people, if we were more accepting and inclusive and equitable and diverse. I went down a rabbit hole in terms of kind of like preparing for this conversation. And I found it both informative, but also emotional at times, because, you know, you think about the experiences that you have in life where you've experienced microaggressions and overt racism, and it brings up a lot. And what I found, though, the conclusion I came to was the more that I learned and the more research that I did, the more I don't know anything. And will I ever know enough? Which I feel like is a good place to start. EDI at times can feel frustrating and stagnant. if you're waiting for change to happen. And I love that you refer to DEI as a journey, because it does feel like sometimes you are just waiting for change, and you've asked for it, and you've asked your employers to do things to make things happen, but time for change is long. Do you have any helpful tips for not getting discouraged or exhausted on that journey?
Oh, that's a good question. I think part of it depends on who you are in the journey, right? So if you are a person that is a part of a historically marginalized group, what's going to be helpful for you is likely going to be different than the person that may be right now in a dominant group. That is also on the journey. And so I think for if you have been, if you're a part of a historically marginalized group, part of it is being able to find community within your workspace, because there are times where you have to look at someone and say, did this just happen? Right? Like you kind of need that. I'm not crazy, right? Like this is actually, so I think, and I have experience where there needs to be somebody, hopefully, that you can, close the door and have a conversation with when, things happen, because we need an outlet like that. But I think there's also, for people who are in groups that have been historically marginalized, the need to be able to raise issues with people in leadership, with people across levels of the organization, in ways that consistently highlight the challenges that are faced. And that can be hard, because I know so many, it's not the responsibility of people who have been oppressed to, to change things. But I think without our effort, I don't think change happens. And I mean, I hate to say it, but I don't think change happens. It doesn't happen without us. And so being willing to be a part of those conversations, I think is important. But your question was about, what to do when it gets exhausting. And I think it's really self-care is to have that community, is to find people, hopefully in the same workspace as you, but if not even outside, where you can, vent, where you can game plan, strategize, to have that level of support, because it may not be from inside the building. And then I think for people who are a part of the dominant group or dominating group, part of the challenge may be, and I've seen this where people are so enthusiastic about trying to, advocate for a change, and they're always speaking up. They're always, and they just feel like they're talking against, they're talking to, a closed door. And I think part of the strategy for people in those groups is to step back and really think strategically, how can change happen? And that's why, even for our organization, our tagline, our philosophy is learn, grow, act. And part of the learning in this instance is really learning your environment, right? Screaming at a door isn't going to change something. So what's a better strategy to try to advocate for change? It's not an easy answer, and organizations are different, individuals are different. But I think part of, if you're a part of a dominating group, then the work of advocating for change is being strategic. And then the work of self-care is also being able to step back, have community, maybe with the people who are, a part of groups that have been oppressed, but to find community, so that, because this isn't solo work, because this is
Absolutely.
a team effort all the way. And so finding community, I think, is really, really important.
I love that. Snaps for that. I love that you said that, we have to be part of the change because we have the experience, and in order for there to be change, they have to know the lived experience. So we have to be a part of the process. How do you, and this was not one of my questions, this is the organic conversation. When leaders come and they want to make the change, I think sometimes they are enthusiastic about wanting to make the change. But if you're in an organization where you are the only person of a marginalized group, you become the standard bearer. You become the go-to person of information. You are the encyclopedia for you, and you're the representation of everyone of what you represent. How do you find the balance between being helpful in those kind of conversations and not going as far as saying, well, you have the same internet that I do. Because you want to be a part of the process and you want to be helpful, but also we are not a monolith. Every Black woman is not the same as me. Every Black person is not the same as me. I cannot speak for every Black person. I cannot speak for every woman. So how do you find that balance between you have the internet and let's have this conversation together?
That happens so much. That happens so much. I have been in that. I'm a Black woman for your listeners. And you know, I've been in that situation where it's like, Julie, ask Julie, call Julie, ask her about this, you know, this social media post. Ask her about the, you know, that's not what I do, right? So it's like, why am I in this meeting? Right? I don't even do this. I'm meeting with the account. I'm like, what, you know, like just pulling somebody in because of their characteristics, because of their, you know, skill set in an area, but because, you know, there's this lack of understanding and this very surface level understanding of the challenges that people face and that are truly happening within organizations. And so at that surface level, oh, well, if you're, you know, Hispanic or Latinx, well, then you should, you know, talk to this other person that's Hispanic. And they're like, but that doesn't, that's, I'm an accountant. Like, why am I here? That's not my frame in, right? Like, that's, what are we talking about? So for your question, you know, what do you do when it's like, you know, if you feel like you're constantly being pulled on into conversations, into situations to share your perspective, et cetera, and that's not your skill set to be that type of mediator, facilitator, you know, planner, et cetera. I think part of it is saying, hey, look, I know that this, you know, is important, right? We're going to validate the importance. And this needs specialized support. There are people who are trained in this. This is not something that I do at my, this is, you know, while I'm a member of this group, this isn't specialized work that I do. My expertise is in accounting or, you know, fashion design, right? My expertise is not in, you know, working with people within an organization to identify barriers, challenges, opportunities to create more inclusive spaces, to create more equity. That's not what I do. And I think sometimes it's breaking it down and helping them see, like, this is actually what you're trying to do, but that's not my skill set. So we would be best served by getting someone who actually has that skill set.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. That I'm sure is going to be helpful for a lot of people who are listening, who have been faced with that kind of a conundrum that, you know, especially when it's a comes from someone who is in leadership. Oftentimes you feel like, ugh, I really want to keep my job, but I don't have the answer for you.
And sometimes, you know, saying no to a person in leadership can feel like you're walking on a tightrope, right? Because someone's come to you. Maybe it's great because now they, you know, they see you, but then they're seeing you for a skill set that's not really in your tool, but you know, in your toolkit. So, you know, saying, hey, this is actually what is most needed. And if you're willing to, you know, do anything more, if you're willing to be on the committee, if you're, or if it's like, you know, this is a whole nother job, right? Like, you know, but making sure that that person understands there is a skill set for what they're seeking. It's not just because you wear glasses, let's let you talk to all the people that wear glasses. Like, that's, you need
Right.
a question, right? So,
Right. And that is not my job.
right. I'm in the group, but that's not what I
But
do.
that's not what I do. Is there a way for us to, because things change so much in society, things, you know, get named and gain in popularity. How do we keep up with change? And this is why I need to have smart people like you on the show to educate me, because I by no means want to offend anyone, right? But I feel like sometimes there's a new term to learn, whether it be for gender identity, whether it be part of the LGBT community. There just seems to be new terms to learn every now and then, and it's hard to keep up. So how do we stay informed and still have the ability to make mistakes? Because as I said, I don't know everything. I went on this journey and I still don't know everything.
That's a great question. I think part of it is A, recognizing that we're all learning. So I think in here in the United States especially, there's this belief that you're supposed to know everything. You're supposed to instantly somehow know, and that being curious, asking questions is unacceptable or inappropriate. And I think leading with curiosity is far more comfortable, quite honestly, and far less stressful, feeling like I have to know all the new terms all the time. I have to know, is it Latinx? Is it Latine? Is it like, what are we saying today? Right? Like, I have to go read all the books, and I have to, on top of my whole other job, and I have to, whereas it's like, no, you can ask. Right? We can ask. We can ask questions. We can have conversations. And so I think part of it is releasing this idea that we've got to just know all this stuff all the time. I think it's unrealistic and it's not helpful and it's really stressful. Now, the second part to that is, okay, well, who do you ask? Right? Right? So, okay, great. I can ask, but who do I ask, and how do I ask without offending someone? And how do I ask in a ways, in ways that aren't going to put pressure on other people who may not be willing to have these conversations. And I think for that, the answer is really looking at who is in your circle, right? So many studies show that our circles are, by and large, well, depending on our racial identity, our circles can be incredibly homogenous, right? You have very few people of any racial identity. I think there was a study I saw years ago about the average white person, their friendship circle is, I think, like 90 something, maybe high 95% white, right? For a lot of reasons, location, where people live, segregation of home, of neighborhoods, all these things. So it's like, if you don't have anybody in your circle, that's, an opportunity, right? It's a little bit more, it's more diverse when we look at people of other racial identities, simply because of how our society is structured in terms of who's in your circle. But I think having people, finding people to ask is important so that we can have conversations. And then also, that's one part. So like finding people, that I think is probably the easiest way. The next way is, one of the reasons why there's so much angst, I will say, is because we're looking at things from such a far distance. We're not really connected to it. And so part of the one of the things that I do and I advocate for is for people to, diversify their media diet, to diversify people they're following, to diversify what they're reading, right? If you're on Instagram, or you're on, any of these social media platforms, who are the people that you're following? Everybody your same racial identity, sexual orientation, education level, right? Like, 'cause if so, then it's going to be hard to understand someone from a different perspective, like different life experience, right? But if you've got, if you're following a trans journalist, for example, that's going to give you some insight into a community that, if you're not a part of the trans community, is going to give you some exposure to issues, to concerns that you probably wouldn't naturally or, regularly hear about. And so part of it is also just in our daily cycles, giving ourselves more opportunity for exposure for things and for people and experiences we typically wouldn't have. And I think that's part of it too.
Thank you so much. I'm just, if people could see me, I'm just like nodding my head and very like, I want to be very audible and excitable, but you're giving so much good knowledge that I want to make sure that it is uninterrupted, that people get it. This is such good advice because I think sometimes you have the questions and you're curious and you want to know, but you want to make sure that you're approaching it from a place of, I want to know about you and your experience and not you as a representative for everybody that is like you. And I think that sometimes people struggle. I know I struggle with that sometimes, is approaching people who are different from me, who have different experiences, with I have a genuine curiosity to know about you and your experience, because I know that you are an individual. What do you think the impact of this shift for the U.S. will be on a global scale? Will it have any global impact?
That's a big question. I think many years ago, I would say we're going to be far more equitable because, you know, the numbers are going to shift and Black and brown people will be in the majority and, you know, will increase in political power and, you know, all these things. And I look around and, you know, what's happening politically, we see the incredible backlash, right? The incredible attempts to reframe DEI, right? I think the co-opting of language is so fascinating to me because redefining terms and making terms that want like woke, right? What was the movie Get Out, right? And it starts with the song Stay Woke.
Absolutely.
And, you know, woke had a whole different, we had a different understanding. We watching Get Out of woke than, you know, what some people in society have really done an excellent job of trying to redefine woke and align it with a negative connotation, so much to the fact that people don't even know what it means, but they just know it's bad, right? They know that anything that reflects or advocates for inclusion and equity is somehow negative. And I think part of what we're seeing, and we see that with, you know, a lot of these, you know, voting laws that are, you know, they're coming into place. We see it with a lot of attempts to limit civil rights. We see it with a lot of these LGBTQ plus laws, especially these anti-trans laws. So we see it with a lot of efforts to limit people within society. And it's like, I think it's because there's a segment of our population that truly understands what's possible, right? And we have a multiracial society where everybody can come together. And then we have a part of our society that is vehemently against that, right? And so I think it is going to take an incredible amount of intention and labor for people who truly are on the side and who truly want inclusion for that to actually happen. One of the things that often inspires me, Jay-Z has a video, I think it's called Family Feud. And in the video, it's this movie and the video is in the future. And at one point it's like a reimagining of the United States. And he's, you know, has this scene where women are the leaders. And you have an indigenous woman who is the president, I believe. You have a Black woman, you have Asian women, you have white women, you have Hispanic women. Everyone is at the table debating and deciding the laws of the nation. And when I saw that many years ago, I was like, that's what we want. Like, we want representation. Now, granted, I said women, so I didn't say non-binary folks. I didn't say men. So it wasn't fully inclusive, but it's a reimagining of, you know, so much different than what we have now. And like, that to me is the ideal. Like, how can we all be at the table? How can we all collectively work together to create a society and organizations that work for everyone versus what we have today, which is a society that only works, that does not work for everyone in a similar way, right? So it doesn't work at all. And you know, and so how do we create that? And I think that's where it's a lot of intention. It's not an easy question to answer because there's so many variables.
They all have very different meanings. Mm-hmm. So equity is different from diversity, which is different from inclusivity, which is different from accessibility. Mm-hmm. And something can be diverse, but not inclusive.
Absolutely.
I feel like I heard this somewhere, so I know I did not make this up. Because I was thinking, okay, if you have a group of 5 men, that can be a diverse group of men. You can have a white man, a Black man, a gay man, an Asian older man, and a young immigrant. It's a diverse group of men, but it is not inclusive because there are no non-binary people. There are no women. There are no trans people. And so it's not inclusive, but it is a diverse group of men. And I think that that is something that I feel trips people up a little bit, because they can look at it and say, well, this is what you asked for. You asked for diversity. I'm giving you diversity. Okay, but what about the other part of that, which is inclusivity, or where is it equitable? You know, so how do we counter that? Like, how do we fight? Well, I don't want to use fight because I feel like that's too strong, but how do we approach that kind of thinking?
I think part of it comes with understanding, like a lot of times when people say diversity, the default is race, right? Even thinking back to the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge.
Yes.
Right. There was a tweet. I don't remember who it was from, but they said Baltimore had a DEI mayor. Right.
Okay.
Do you remember? I don't know if you
said. I did not see this, but I can imagine.
So, you know, a DEI mayor. Right. So, you know, this DEI is like coded. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, are you just want to say, like, what do you really want to say? Right. You want to say the N-word? What are you trying to say? Black? What are you trying to say? And so a lot of times we think diversity, the default is race. And the reality is there are far more. I mean, diversity is so broad. We're talking race. We're talking age. We're talking gender. We're talking gender identity. We're talking marital status, socioeconomic status. We're talking language. We're talking nationality. We're talking ethnicity. There are so many ways in which people can be diverse. And so I think part of, you know, how do we overcome this is the mental labor of now pausing when we hear DEI and our diversity and thinking, wait a minute, it's more than just race.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, part of the work that there is to overcome is these mental shortcuts, these mental kind of fast roads that don't really allow us to think as deeply, because that's what I think allows us to make decisions that, you know, are limiting or not truly expansive, because we're on these mental shortcuts. Diversity is race. The DEI mayor, which is awful language, right? But it's an intentional association to create a negative connotation about a person. And so I think part of it is, so I guess to answer your question, it's really looking at how can we truly understand what these words mean, so that when we're saying them, we're either elaborating on the definition so that other people know what we're, you know, how broad we're talking. I mean, there's neurodiversity, right? There's so many ways people could be diverse, as opposed to just saying, well, diversity, and then keep moving, because I think language is so powerful. And that I often, you know, want to make sure we understand words. We don't just say the word, we understand the meaning. And I think there's a difference.
I think everyone is familiar with overt racism and how belittling and negative that is. But can you help us unravel microaggressions and unconscious bias? How do those fit into the EDI journey, and how is breaking those down helpful to move us forward?
Yeah. So I will say this before I start. I love psychology. I love understanding the brain, and I'm fascinated by understanding how the ways our society has been structured by the laws that have been passed over centuries, by the narratives that have been perpetuated over centuries, how those have taken root in people's minds for generations, passed from mother to grandmother, you know, all along the line. And so now we have deeply planted within our society unconscious biases.
Mm-hmm.
And unconscious biases are really, you know, a bias is a preference for or against something generally in a way that's perceived as unfair, right? You can be biased and consciously biased, right? I have a bias for Nike over Adidas, right? Right. Like, or you know, but something
that's
not unfair, but you know, there's a, you have a conscious preference for something. The unconscious part is where it gets real tricky, because let's say, I mean, just a perfect example is, you know, I was out to, I was out having coffee yesterday with someone who talked to, is a Black man who talked about, you know, walking down the street and hearing people lock their doors, right? That's a result of a number of things. Let's say one of them is unconscious bias, but where does that come from? And so a lot of times we think about unconscious biases, the origins come from our conditioning, from the messages we hear in society, from the things we see on the news or we don't see, right? From the experiences we have or we don't have that lead us to have an impression or a preference for something in ways that we may not truly even understand ourselves because it's so unconscious. And so unconscious biases, it's the actions that are the result of them. That's what's harmful. People have preferences and our brains naturally categorize things, right? Our brains are trying to like help us out. And so they put things and people in categories. So we're not like burning all our energy trying to figure things out. But doing so, our brains move so quickly that we're not always aware of how our brain is just automatically categorizing things and then the decisions we're making based on that. And so, well, just the example I just gave, a black man walking down the street. Someone will see a black man and just lock their car door and probably not think that they're being, racist or that there's a good person. And oh, I just want to be safe. Why? But you didn't do that when the white lady walked down the street or when the Asian man walked down the street, right? And so it is these unconscious conditionings that happen because of, a lot of what we take in, the associations that we make that lead us to lock the door or not. Right. That's one way unconscious bias affects us. And I think that, first of all, everybody has unconscious bias. So it's not like we can just say, I'm gonna just turn this off. Our brains work, right? Like we automatically create categories and then make mental associations about what's safe or not safe or what's good or not good, right? That's how our brains work, trying to keep us safe. But that input we can influence. And just like I said earlier, looking at your media, social media diet, or like where are you getting this information, that can help give you more exposure to Black people, to Asian people, to whatever person type group of people experiences, so that you actually have more information and you don't have to have that automatic response because you actually have more information on which to make your decision.
Thank you so much. Now is and I'm going to ask this question just to make sure I understand. Are we saying that unconscious bias and racism are the same thing? Those are two, they're not the same. Because I don't want people to be confused and be like, "Oh, well, we all have unconscious bias, so everybody's racist." That is not what we're saying here. Those are not the same.
Unconscious bias, and there's so many types of unconscious bias. So we think about there's a type of unconscious bias called affinity bias, right? I'm from Florida. If you tell me you're from Florida, I'll be like, what? I'm all of a sudden gonna feel some kind of way about it, right? Do I know you like that? No, but you're from Florida, so you must be good people, right? And so that's a type of unconscious bias. It is a preference or something, even though we have no data to back it up, but you told me one thing, that's going to influence how I feel about the situation, right? There's gender bias, which is not always unconscious, but the preference for people of different genders. There's this concept of beauty bias, right? People who fit this stereotypical European informed beauty features, people prefer that. We think of actors, we think of models, right? There's this beauty bias that exists, and we see it all the time, which I think is one of the reasons why it's so noteworthy when people who don't fit that norm are chosen as the star or chosen as the focal point for a play or a show or, a book or anything like that. So there's a lot of ways in which bias exists. Bias is not the same as racism. Microaggressions, and you and I, we met because I led a session about microaggressions. And microaggressions are, they are the slights. They are the mental slights, the verbal slights, the subtle, as I think is a great way to describe microaggressions, ways of interacting with people, treating people that are really demeaning. Often they are delivered in ways that would likely seem a little, hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And microaggressions, I think a lot of times we think having the Nazi swastika, right? Like that's overt. But someone saying something about the racial group you belong to, or about your appearance or your hair texture or things like that, can be harmful. And the challenge or the issue with microaggressions, and there are many, is that because they're so subtle, they happen all the time. And when you are the target of a microaggression, it's like a mind game sometimes, because you're often questioning, did that really happen? For example, I'll give you and your listeners an example. I went to a restaurant, and I'm still mad about it because clearly I'm telling you all. Maybe it was a couple months ago. I went to this restaurant, and three Black women, me and two of my friends, we were like, I think we're the only Black people in the restaurant. And we're there eating, dining, and we had reservations, right? We come in at 5:30, and around 7:15, so it hadn't been 2 hours yet, we're eating dinner. And the manager, I guess, comes over and it's like, we have another group that has reserved this table. So we need you all to leave. And we're like, we're actually eating our dessert. And we're like, what? Put the receipt down and, all these things. And we're like, what? And then we're like, well, we're going to finish our dessert. And we were having a great conversation. It was like a Friday night. And, then they kept coming by and standing beside us and moving chairs, and we can't create like a very hostile environment. Now, I will say I'm vegan, so mm-hmm. I ordered something. They didn't bring it out correctly, so I sent it back. And I'm like, is that what it was? Like, we were the only people that were facing this type of, kind of circling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Leave. And so as we were leaving, I'm looking around. I'm like, well, those people were here before us, and those people were here before us, and the only difference that I can tell is our skin color, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're kind of like, is this really, and so it's one of those things where these slights, it's just, it's very subtle. You don't always notice it in the moment, but it lingers.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it makes you feel like you don't belong, like yeah. somehow you are not supposed to be there.
Yeah. It can make you question who you are and your feelings about yourself. It's funny. It's interesting. It's not ha-ha funny, but it is funny that you bring up a situation like that. I went to a beauty supply store in the area that I had been to before. And I was on the phone talking to my mom while I was in there, minding my own business. I knew what I came in there to do. And I was standing in the aisle looking for like rubber bands or something like that. And a woman who I cannot recall ever seeing there before, the aisle is in front of me and I'm looking at the merchandise and she's standing at the other end of the aisle. She works there, but she's an older woman standing at the end of the aisle, kind of like leaning over, kind of trying to see what I'm doing. And in my mind, I was like, first of all, I just got here. Secondly, I'm on the phone, which means that if I was in here to steal something, that's not how you come in here. Thirdly, this is not my first time. Like, I was really, and I was on the phone with my mom and I was like, I am about to lose my mind in here because I didn't do anything wrong. I want to give you my money and you are making it seem like I've already done something. And I thought, okay, let me do an experiment. I'm going to leave this aisle. And I'm going to go somewhere else in the store and see what happens. And I was like, oh, I have a shadow. And I was just like, you know what? Let me hurry up. And this will be the last time that I come here.
Yeah.
Because that's unnecessary. I didn't do any. And I didn't do anything. And if you wanted to know if I was going to steal something, just ask me, because that you are one step from that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's so belittling and unnerving to have that kind of an experience. Mm-hmm. Part of me wanted to be outwardly vocal and say, is there something that I can help you with?
Right.
I don't work here, but is there something I can help you with? Because right. obviously you need my help. But then the other part of that is that you don't want to lean into that label of being, oh, this is another angry Black woman. She's already showing me that this is the reason why I needed to follow her around. And it's, how do we navigate that? How mm-hmm. do you how do you fight that unconscious bias? Because part of me does want to go back there and start following her around, or make it known that I'm gonna keep giving you my money to show you that I'm trustworthy. But why do I have to do all of the work?
Right. It's really hard. And it goes back to a little what I was saying earlier about psychology, because you're dealing with people who have believed these societal messages, stereotypes, what have you. And the challenging part about microaggressions is that when you point it out, what happens? That's not what I was doing. That's not what I meant. No, you have it all wrong. Right. And so it is really, that's why I say it's hard, because which is why I think it persists, is because often the people who are perpetuating it are in denial, are unaware of how their actions are actually of A, the motivation, and B, how it's actually impacting and landing on people. And it's just the same, and what we're talking about, being followed in a store and, pressured to move or to do something. It, in many ways, more common or other common microaggressions could be, that whole, where are you from? Right? No, where are you really from? Because you can't be from here. So where are you really from? And it's like, no, but I am from here. And why do you care so much? Right? Like, it is this, I have an idea of what an American is, of what beauty is, and you fall outside that. Right? Like, that's the microaggression. And so it's really hard, your question, how do you confront it? It's hard to confront it when you're dealing with people on the other side who are rooted in denial about it. I wish I had a better answer. A lot of times microaggressions go unaddressed because nobody wants to, now I've been insulted. And if I tell you I've been insulted, now you're going to deny that you insulted me. Now I'm going to be extra hot because I just told you what happened and I'm wasting my time. Never mind.
Right.
I'm just not coming
Now you're gonna gaslight me, and that's gonna make me
back.
more mad.
Right. So how about I'm not coming back. And that's what happens.
It's a lot of just making the determine as the person who's being microaggressed is making the decision to be like, I'm just not gonna deal with this. I'm just gonna move on. It is not worth the time or the energy to get into a battle with a person who is not ever going to come to the realization. They lack the self-awareness to really have the conversation.
Especially if it's a stranger.
Oh, yes.
Now, if it's somebody, let's say somebody in the workplace, there might be, depending on the relationship, there might be a chance you could have a conversation about it. But for strangers, your listeners can't see me, but I'm shaking my head. Like
Shake. They're probably shaking along with you. Just shake your head.
it's really it's on. I mean, it's really hard.
And that's why I go back to what I said at the top, is that I love that you said that EDI is a journey. There's really, you can't say we're in the middle of EDI. We're at the end, because there is no end. There is always something to learn.
And I think that can sometimes be off-putting to people, because in our society, we like instant pudding, we like shake and bake, we like, I'm done, I'm on to the next thing. What do you mean I'm not done? And it's a journey because we're always growing, we're always evolving, things are always moving, things come up. And so we need to be able at various times to address things, right? I like to say, I took biology in high school. Don't ask me about biology, right? I can't tell you anything about it. I took a whole class. I probably got good grades, but don't ask me about it because I don't know, right? Like, we have to stay current. We have to stay connected and present with the present time, which is why it is a journey.
What are some things that might hinder an organization from moving forward on their EDI journey?
There are a number of things. I think one of them, something we've talked about is not having a clear understanding of what EDI is, right? I've seen organizations that just weren't really clear on, you know, A, that diversity is more than race. A, that what these terms really mean, and having a limited or incomplete understanding of what EDI, DEI, however you arrange the letters, what it really means and what it could mean for their organization. I think things that hold an organization back are a desire to hold on to what's familiar, a fear of losing something if things were to change in ways that they can't really envision, right? What does it mean when we change who we hire? What does it mean when we change how we're structured so that we're more inclusive? Change is hard.
Ooh, say it again, girl. Say it again.
It's hard. And it doesn't have to be an EDI type of change. Any type of change is hard. So most people, I think, would rather just do with what's comfortable than change. And so we talk about organizations changing and changing how we engage with each other. That is a different level of work. And I think to do that, a much higher vision has to be in place and has to be a unified goal that people are truly excited about as far as what can be, so that we can be united on our journey to get there. I think what can also hold companies back is unrealistic expectations. This belief that, okay, so we're going to hire someone, they're going to come in for 3 months, they're going to do a turnaround, and we're going to be set, right? It's unrealistic expectations. We're going to have a workshop and it's going to change everything. We are going to, you know, and so I think part of it is having a very clear understanding of why, you know, like most things in life, what is your why? Why are you doing this? And why does that matter so much, right? Asking that, you know, the asking why 5 times to really get to the core of it. So we understand, what are we trying to do here? Then we can, once we know what we're trying to do and it makes sense, then we can get on board with, well, what's the strategy that's going to help us create this organization that can thrive in a multiracial society, in a society where people can feel like they can show up in their full self, whatever their gender identity or expression may be, right? Like, how do we create that? I think that's where the work comes in. But it, I think part of it, it's having that clear why and understanding. And I think a lot of times with organizations, that limited understanding of the terms, the kind of fear of change, the fear of what they know, what they're so familiar with, changing, are some of the ways that can hold organizations back from truly, you know, really going into a higher version of themselves.
It's about the work. It's about wanting to do the work, wanting to put in the work and having that desire for change. Is there an, I'm thinking about this question and I already feel like I know the answer. Is there an ideal, what does EDI in perfect practice look like? Is there an ideal EDI situation? What does it look like for an organization to be equitable, diverse, and inclusive all around? What would that look like?
I feel like I've seen aspects of that in various organizations. I've seen organizations that are incredibly diverse and, you know, they openly talk about, well, wait a minute, who's missing? We need, we know there's too many of y'all over here. We need to mix this up. We need some more diverse perspectives. Who wants to join this team over here? Right. Like, and they welcome the conversation, which I just find admirable, to be able to have a conversation in a workplace and say, hey, we value a variety of perspectives. We know that to win, we need people that can look at this from multiple angles. And so let's get a team of people that have that diverse perspective so we can really see the full gamut of, you know, what it is we're trying to achieve. Right? And so I've seen organizations that are just, you know, really diverse and inclusive in that way as well. I was reading, well, no, that's actually not a good example. I was reading something today about equity in schools with algebra, which is a whole nother. It's in the New York Times today. It's hard. Equity, achieving equity is challenging, especially in large systems like a school system. But another example of, I would say I've seen accessibility become much more intentional at, at theaters. We think about accessibility in terms of people who may have difficulty hearing or difficulty with mobility. I think there's still ways in which we're seeing accessibility, people expanding their understanding of accessibility to be more than, a ramp, right? Less than they have a walker or a wheelchair. But we're starting to see more of that, which I think is great. And so I don't know of a single organization that I have, I would say is like 10 stars all across. But I've seen elements of it. And, and I think organizations are working on it. It is hard work to look at where an organization is, recognizing they've taken a lot of time and energy to build what they have, to only be told, yeah, and it's not inclusive. And then to have to look at what they've built and kind of deconstruct how it's set up to see, well, how could it be more inclusive? And to be willing to say, and not only say, okay, we're going to make these changes, but to invest in doing that as well. So whether it's their website, whether it's their recruitment process, whether it's their promotion process, whether it is their onboarding, whether it is their vendors, right? Like there's so many ways in which organizations can promote more diversity and equity and inclusion in their culture and operations, but it's being able to sit down and say, okay, let's actually look at the whole thing. Like we're going to just do an overall assessment and let's see where we are. And then let's see where you're trying to go. And then what are some of the highest leverage things we can do to help move you closer to your goals? And I think that's the path, but that's why it's a journey.
Oh my goodness, Julie. Thank you so much for that. I feel like that's a natural like kind of place to stop here for this conversation. This was a gift. Thank you so much. I feel so blessed to have had this conversation with you. Before I let you go, here at Sleepless Nights, we have a tradition. I ask all of my guests this because this podcast is about being awake in the middle of the night and your thoughts just racing. Is there, or would you like to share one thing that keeps you up at night?
Yes. For your listeners, I had to take a long pause. I'm looking around, I'm like, do I say it? The answer is yes. So one thing that keeps me up at night is I look at our society and I look at how people in power are advocating for policies and practices that limit human rights, that limit opportunity, that inhibit inclusion and equity and all the things that I believe are so very important for us in our society. And so one thing that keeps me up at night is I constantly, and it keeps me up during the daytime too, but I constantly, am looking for, I see how organized one side of this effort is. I want to know what is happening on the other side. Who's organizing the defense? And how can the defense become the offense, right? So I want to know. That's what keeps me up at night. I see the strategy and the long-term plan and vision and patience of people who want to inhibit an inclusive society, who don't want that. I want to know, what are the people who are like, nah, we want an inclusive society, and these are all the things we're doing to make that possible. I don't see a equal reaction to their action. And that's one thing that keeps me up at night.
Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of the Sleepless Nights podcast. Go get some rest and join us next time for an all new episode and all new conversations. Stay sleepy, everyone. Good night.
The Sleepless Nights podcast is brought to you by Greatest City Collective and is hosted by me, Danielle Hutchinson. It is edited and engineered by Jake Zarenko and executive produced by Davinia Shorter. Music is provided by DJ D. Hutch. Join us in 2 weeks for another episode of Sleepless Nights. Thanks for listening, and remember, stay sleepy.